You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his latest book on economics, Cambridge University professor Ha-Jun Chang quotes John Kenneth Galbraith, who said, "The only function of economic forecasting is to make astrology respectable." Professor Chang is one of several noted economists raising concerns about the science of economics. He's called his new book, published by Bloomsbury, Economics, the User's Guide. And in it, he seeks to lay out the various aspects of economics that underline the issues of debate today. I'm very pleased to welcome Ha-Jun Chang to our show. Hello.
Well, pleasure to be here.
Didn't Galbraith say that during the Reagan administration? Is economics still doing as badly as he suggested?
Yeah, Galbraith was probably the best wit among economists. But, you know, he said it in a very deadpan, jokey kind of way. But when he said all these things, he was raising a really important question, because at least for the last century, economists have had this pretense that they are scientists. You know, they are different from anthropologists. They are different from sociologists. Their discipline is exact, quantifiable. No one can debate this. Galbraith, of course, saw through it and kept reminding them that the so-called precision of economic science is quite limited.
So we shouldn't call it a science?
We shouldn't, because, you know, at the beginning, actually, economics was called political economy. You know, people like Adam Smith, they didn't write books on economics. They wrote books on political economy. So there was a recognition from the beginning that it was a fundamentally political argument.
So would you say it still is? Because people do try to separate the two, and yet so much of politics involves economics.
Yeah, and, you know, it's impossible to separate economics from politics, not simply because in day-to-day management of the economy, politics always seeps into economic decisions, but more importantly, what is the economy? What is the boundary of the economy? What is the market? That is a political decision.
So if you were to give a brief definition of economics as an introductory economics course, might stated, what would you say?
Well, economics should be the study of the economy, which is how we produce things, goods and services, how we distribute the income arising from that process, and how we exchange and consume. So it should be about the economy. Unfortunately, these days, economists have this pretense that economics is the science of everything. I mean, you'll be amazed to see how many economics books have everything in its subtitle.
Although in the case of physics, most physicists agree on a lot of basic things. Economists don't seem to agree on
anything. Economics involves ethical judgments, political values. You know, for example, Friedrich von Hayek, the famous Austrian advocate of free market, you know, in his political view, the most important thing in, what he called the civilized society was people's freedom to use their private property as they see fit. And this is why he explicitly advocated the Pinochet military dictatorship in Chile, because he thought the previous government was infringing on people's freedom in that respect. And for him, that was the most important thing. So he didn't really mind the Pinochet regime killing people and locking them up.
Didn't Milton Friedman also consult for the Pinochet regime?
Friedman was another of those people. So, you know, in their books, you know, the freedom to use the property was paramount. And if the freedom to exercise your vote, the freedom to associate, freedom to organize, if those things infringed upon those right to use property, they should be sacrificed. So that's a very explicit political position.
There is an enormous amount of economics reporting out there, and this station, WNYC, even has created a show called Freakonomics Radio. Mm. Do Americans or Britons need more education or more guidance to understand what they're hearing?
Yes, I think so, because, you know, this reporting is done on the assumption that, you know, that the standard free market economics is correct, and, you know, whatever goes against it is criticized and so on. But as I try to explain in the book, there are many different ways of doing economics, so to speak. And people need to know these different approaches to understand what the reporters are saying is correct or incorrect or biased this way, that way. And without that knowledge, you could present economic facts in particular ways to kind of guide people into a particular conclusion without people realizing that that is what is being done.
And you have a chart of 9 different schools of economics here, all thriving today?
Well, that thriving is a relative term. So, well, all those schools exist. Of course, the neoclassical school is by far the most dominant school, probably especially in the English-speaking world. 95% of economists can be called neoclassical.
But which would mean what?
Oh, well, basically, this is a notion of economics which sees the economy as a web of market exchanges. So it sees people as mainly consumers, so they don't really talk about work, production. I mean, it's a very useful tool, but it's the range of issues that it can analyze well is rather limited, but then these limited ways of analysis is presented as be-all and end-all of economics.
Well, we may all be consumers or participants in the economy, but are we all users of economics, whether we like it or not?
Yeah, no, actually, that's what I want to remind people of, because, unfortunately, the economics, more precisely, the free market economics has become the equivalent of Catholic theology in medieval Europe. I mean, this economics is used to justify whatever is happening, however unjust and unfair people think it is. And we need to see through this. And everyone needs to, as a responsible democratic citizen, everyone needs to learn some economics to really understand what's going on.
But some of these rules seem to be applied to everything from the United States and Sweden and Germany and Italy and Singapore and China.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
and yet they're such different political entities.
Exactly, yeah. And in economic terms, they're also very different. I mean, there are some very basic rules like, price goes up, people buy less of that thing and that kind of stuff that applies everywhere. But that the American capitalism is completely different from the Swedish one, which is very different from the Japanese one, which is yet again very different from the Chinese one and so on. So, we need to really understand that when people say, oh, this is the only way, the free market way is the only way and everyone does it or everyone has to do it, otherwise they are all damned. I think that's the biggest myth that we have to part with. And in order to do that, you need to learn some economics to understand why this thing is not true.
In your case, you're from Korea.
Mm-hmm.
You wind up in Cambridge.
Yep.
Economists from all over the world seem to wind up in Cambridge.
Oh, well. They used to, not
or
anymore.
Or Britain. With the focus on Wall Street and banking, do many people now confuse economics and finance?
Yes, there's certainly that. I mean, finance has become so important and powerful in the U.S., in Britain and many other countries, although not everywhere. People come to accept the logic of the financial institutions as logic of the whole economy, which shouldn't be the case.
And then in the news, they tell us about the Dow Jones of the day. What does that really tell us?
Well, basically the Dow Jones is, the stock market price index is tracking the movements of stock market prices, which people think is basically the same thing as the health of the economy. But no, it's not true. I mean, as we saw in the build-up to the 2008 financial crisis, financial bubbles develop, and they can, at least for a significant period, they can run as if they are totally detached from the underlying real economy. Of course, it cannot last forever. That's why we had that crisis. But, you know, if some people try to tell you that, look, Dow Jones is going up, we are doing fine.
And it was going to keep on going up.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, there was a time around the turn of the century when people thought Dow Jones will reach 36,000. So,
my guest is Hajun Chang. His latest book is Economics, the User's Guide. His previous book is 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. We'll probably get into a few of those as well. Last week, there was a conference here in New York City on rethinking economics, looking at what went wrong in the decades before the financial crisis. Has anything similar happened in Britain?
Yeah, no, actually, the rethinking economics originally started in Britain by the university students, and I've been interacting with that group quite closely. Yes, I mean, it's not just Britain or the U.S. All over the world, there's dissatisfaction from students. There's this the initiative called International Student Initiative for Pluralism in Economics, ESIP, which has members in 19 countries at 35 universities. So it is spreading. Students want different kind of economics.
Well, Thomas Piketty is the author of a book that has won a lot of attention this year. He's French. You're from South Korea. Amartya Sen is from India. Are we seeing more economists coming from outside the English-speaking world than we did in the past?
Oh, well, maybe. But, yeah, I think that...
But they all seem to end up in the United States or Great Britain.
Well, the U.S. and Britain are the centers of world economics, like it or not, so that's why it happens. But, yeah, I guess that coming from a different background gives you a slightly different perspective, which allows you to see things a bit differently. So I think that's why some... But these non sort of Anglo people can give some interesting perspectives.
You note, as Paul Krugman did in yesterday's New York Times, a claim by Nobel laureate Robert Lucas that, I'm quoting, the central problem of depression prevention has been solved. Mm. Lucas said that in 2003. Yeah. Does he still believe that? And do any economists, other economists, still believe that?
Well, you'll have to ask Professor Lucas directly whether he still believes it. But yes, I mean, surprisingly, there are still many free market economists who try to argue that the crisis in 2008 was actually caused by too much government regulation rather than excessive deregulation. So, you know, I really don't think there's much common ground to have a recent debate with those people.
There are many people who still believe that inflation is going to be a big problem, and yet inflation seems to have been held off despite all of the predictions of doom and gloom.
Yes, you know, I mean, this the view that when money supply expands, inflation will inevitably rise, which has been made famous by Milton Friedman, among others, has been the central tenet of free market economics. It has been disproven by the last the few years of so-called quantitative easing, when government is pouring money into the system and inflation is not rising.
Well, it would seem to make sense that you put more money into the system and inflation would occur. That's what we saw in Germany during Weimar.
Yeah. No,
why is it different now?
No, other things being equal, that would be the case. But the trouble is that other things are often not the same. So in this the phase of our economic recovery, you know, the companies are not, when they have extra money, they normally would invest. But in this round, they are not investing. They're holding cash. They are not creating enough jobs, and the economic level of economic activity itself is depressed. So there's no extra demand building up because of this liquidity. Because of that behavior by the major corporations and financial institutions, that we are not seeing the rise in the price levels.
I'm speaking with Hajun Chang, who teaches economics at Cambridge University. His writings have been translated into 36 languages in 39 countries, and he's the author of a number of books, including the winner of the 2003 Myrdal Prize, which was The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism? Or was it
no,
Kicking
was
Away
the
Ladder?
Ladder, yeah.
The most recent, the one we're discussing, is Economics, the User's Guide. It is published by Bloomsbury, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ha-Jun Chang of Cambridge University. His latest book, Economics, the User's Guide, published by Bloomsbury. You mentioned the Rethinking Economics movement among students. Mm. What response is it getting from the established faculty, especially free market advocates?
Oh, well, a lot of them are in denial. They try to dismiss the students as, not knowing what they are talking about. But, this is, in a way, the revenge of the market they so love, because now their consumers are saying, well, we don't like the product, give us something different. And what are they going to say? I mean, they've always told other people that consumers are the sovereign, they're the king, market will give whatever the consumers want, and that's the beauty of the capitalist system. Now they have to eat their own words.
So the capitalist system applies to university education as well?
Well, increasingly so. In many European countries, it had been protected from pressure of the market in the last half a century. But yeah, increasingly, especially in the science and technology, research is becoming expensive. You need extra funding, and where do you get that? Of course, partly government, but now the private sector is increasingly involved, and that creates a different type of dynamic.
How important is mathematics in economics today? There's little mathematics in John Maynard Keynes's general theory of employment, interest, and money, even though he was a very good mathematician. And Thomas Piketty and Paul Krugman and others have argued that economists over-rely on mathematics today.
Yes, my view is that, mathematics is like a language, I speak Korean. That doesn't necessarily make me a better person than you who doesn't speak Korean. So math is
just... How do
you
know I don't speak Korean?
Oh, well, no. Very few people outside Korea
I know how to
do.
Say barbecue. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. many economists think that... doing more sophisticated mathematics means doing better economics, but that's not true. I mean, it has to have contents. I mean, mathematics is just a way of expressing your theory, and the very fact that your tool is better doesn't mean that what you make is better. I mean, judgment has to rely on what you in the end produce. Unfortunately, a lot of people mix the technical sophistication with better theory, and that's one big problem with economics these days.
In the age when Adam Smith was describing the division of labor in a pin factory, was it reasonable to speak of individuals as individual people? Are individuals today now companies or just fantastically wealthy individuals?
Yes, actually, the interesting thing is that Adam Smith, of course, did talk about individuals, but his theory was basically based on classes. I mean, Adam Smith and his followers basically saw the society as made up of three classes: capitalists, workers, and landlords, and they try to analyze.
Sounds very Marxist to me.
Yeah. No, Marx learned it from those people. So, for them, I mean, individual choices really didn't matter. I mean, it was individuals acting as a member of a particular class, not individuals as a standalone, independent, atomized category as it later came to be in the neoclassical economics. So, he had a very different vision, but yes, I mean, compared to those days, we have actually the very different cast in our economic drama, because today corporations have become huge and very influential.
And become people.
Yes.
In the eyes of the U.S. Supreme Court.
No, actually, in the 19th century, there's a big debate, especially in the U.S., but also in other European countries, whether corporations should be made a legal person. A lot of people believe that this is just collection of people, and that doesn't make it a person. In the end, it was given a kind of legal personality, which then allowed it to do certain things. But this was not a foregone conclusion in the past.
Another thing that we have heard about over the years is rational choice. Mm. Hasn't choice or rational choice been one of the thorniest issues in economics and political science for decades?
Yes, a lot of economists have very strong belief that the humans are rational. I mean, they may not be perfect, but they would at least have to act rationally in order to survive in the natural selection of the economic game. And therefore, they built the whole theoretical edifice assuming a very high degree of rationality of individuals, which Herbert Simon, the 20th century polymath, who was also a winner of Nobel Prize in Economics, called Olympian rationality. He said this is godlike rationality that no one has.
But it also sounds like it should be more in the realm of psychology than economics.
Yes, actually, the people are now slowly waking up to the fact that this kind of the model of hyper-rationality, Olympian rationality, as Simon called it, is not just unrealistic, but it actually hampers our understanding of the economy because people are, as people like Keynes have emphasized, people are driven by instinct, herd behavior, intuitive thinking and so on. And actually, people who have been influenced by Simon have kind of introduced a lot of interesting ideas into economics that are called behavioral economics.
If there had been totally rational decision-making, rational choice, then Bernie Madoff wouldn't have been such a success.
Exactly. And also, Alan Greenspan kept telling us that there is no bubble in the U.S. housing market until 1 year before the whole thing collapsed. And then he admitted there might be some local froth. So this distorted view came from the deep belief in the rationality of economic actors, which created this unmanageable consequence.
Does that come out of Ayn Rand to some degree, rather than an economist?
Oh, no. I mean, because
she had influence in the area of philosophy,
no,
but
of course, yeah.
Economics as well.
No, but economics has always been focused on this, at least from the late 19th century. The whole neoclassical school building a whole theoretical edifice on the assumption that people are selfish and rational, and it is a central doctrine of modern neoclassical economics.
My guest is Hajun Chang. His book, Economics, The User's Guide, is published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's get back to those nine different schools of economics. Mm. There's now a lot of interest in behavioral economics,
yep.
Neuroeconomics, mm-hmm. evolutionary economics. Mm-hmm. Could the direction of influence be changing?
Yeah, I think so. It's slowly changing. Now, actually, of the nine schools I listed, the evolutionary school and neuroeconomics school don't even make the cut because they are relatively minor. But yes, I mean, now the people have come to realize that this model of hyper-rational, selfish individual is far too inadequate. And now there are a lot of different schools that are being explored by many different people. So, yeah, I'm hopeful that economics will recover its more kind of nuanced and sophisticated nature.
If Adam Smith were to come back today, would he recognize the various economic elements?
Well, unfortunately, he wouldn't because,
consumers, corporations, markets, central banks, governments.
Yeah,
such.
Well, the world he lived in was, a world where 20 people working together to make a pen was considered quite cool, Today, we have corporations with literally millions of employees operating in, several dozen countries with very complex hierarchies and it's a completely different world. So yes, we can learn from his wisdom in many ways, but if you think that you can apply that kind of rather simplistic free market thinking that there is an invisible hand and it will take care of everything, then we are seriously mistaken.
And then, of course, a machine is making the pin these days.
Exactly, yeah.
Taxation and redistribution were divisive issues 200 years ago, and they still are. Are economists as divided as the American or European people are?
Yes, there are some economists who believe that taxes are basically a waste of money. Of course, the reality is much more complex. You know, let me put it this way. You know, if a low tax was so good, why don't everyone migrate to Jamaica? You know, they have a top income tax rate of 5%. Yeah? If a low corporation tax is so good, why don't all companies go to Albania, where top corporate income tax rate is 10%? Of course, people don't go to these countries because what they get for even that low taxes, not good value for money, you know.
Although,
in contrast, people would invest in countries like Sweden or Finland, where personal income tax rate would be 50%, 60%, that corporation taxes at 20-25%. So, because they think they are getting the worth of their tax because these governments provide well-educated and healthy workers, good infrastructure, and support for research and development.
So why do people in this country argue that we have the most oppressive corporate taxes in the world?
Oh!
Considering the fact that our economy is still doing pretty well.
Yeah, well, I think guys corporations that always want to pay less tax.
They buy a company in Albania and they pay Albanian taxes.
Well, I mean, what they normally do is to set up these paper companies in the Virgin Islands or the Liechtenstein, these places, and basically cook the books so that all the profits end up in those countries and very little ends up in the United States. Now, U.S. Corporation taxes are, you know, relatively high compared to its personal income tax, but, you know, the belief that somehow it's a tax that is a problem is, disproved even by the experience of the United States itself. In the 1950s, under Eisenhower, your top income tax rate was 92%. The U.S. economy is growing much faster than what it is today. I mean, I'm not saying that there's a direct simplicity.
No, it was the end of World War II. There were other issues going on.
Yeah, causation there. But, if tax was so important, I mean, that kind of thing could not have happened.
In that 2003 speech I mentioned earlier, Robert Lucas advocated incentives to work and to save as opposed to fine-tuning of spending flows, and he criticized what he called short-run demand management. Was he talking about taxes and transfers?
Oh, well, I think he was probably mainly talking in terms of budget deficit, you know, this Keynesian idea that when there's a shortfall in demand from the private sector, the government should step in and spend more than it receives. Now, I mean, for me, I mean, it's a very commonsensical view, but unfortunately, a lot of economists do not believe in that.
With the problems in the United States or parts of Europe, how are countries like Sweden or Norway or South Korea viewing the economic approach that dominates in the United States?
Well, unfortunately, the U.S. Has so much influence all over the world that even these countries are becoming more accepting of free market approaches to the economy. But I will make 2 points. One is the U.S. wasn't always like that. You know, I mean, the kind of protectionism that countries like South Korea used to develop the so-called infant industries was invented in the United States by no less person than Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary of this country. So until the Second World War, the U.S. wasn't this kind of free market economy as people think. And secondly, you know, of course, you need both market and government. You know, you cannot walk on one leg. But I think, unfortunately, in the last 3 decades, the U.S. Has become too biased towards one direction, and that has had, in my view, unfortunate influences on other economies as well.
Liberal is often used as a political label, but you say it's the most confusing term in the world.
Yes, in the 19th century, actually being liberal meant being anti-democratic because in the 19th century Europe, and I mean, this was common in the across Europe, being liberal meant being like Hayek, I mentioned earlier, putting the biggest emphasis on the freedom to use private property. And the liberals of those days objected to democracy because they thought that if you gave votes to poor people, they would vote against the rich, against the property class, and destroy the economy. So, you know, in Europe, the word liberal is still used in that kind of connotation, whereas in America, liberal is basically what Europeans call social democratic.
When we mentioned the Dow Jones, but there are other ways that we hear about our economy. The larger issue that's considered critical is growth, especially growth in gross domestic product. Mm. Is there consensus on whether that's the most important thing or whether it's gross national product or the Gini coefficient or the Human Development Index or the Happy Planet Index?
Right, yeah, no, there are
GDP.
Yeah, so many different ways of measuring economic performance. Now, GDP is the preferred measure among economists because it's mainly focused about the output that can be easily measured. And domestic, which means that you count everything, whether the company is producing things in your country are your own national companies or foreign companies, that gives you an overview of what's going on within your economy. But, you know, the fact that this is the preferred measure and possibly the single best measure doesn't mean that you have to use only that. I mean, there are many supplementary measures like Gini coefficient and other measures of income inequality. I mean, there are measures that look at the work and life balance. For example, the OECD in Paris has developed all sorts of measures trying to measure quality of life broader than income. So we should look at all of this together.
And many people are looking at income inequality as a major factor today.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But how does this apply to the developing world? The same rules apply?
Well, as a rule, the developing countries are far more unequal than the developed countries. You know, the U.S. is very unequal for a rich country. But if you drop the United States in the middle of Latin America or Africa, it will be one of the most equal countries in those continents. Yeah?
Now, in the past, you've argued that if the Japanese had thought like the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman and free trade advocates, Japan never would have developed into an economic power.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I was there explicitly referring to the company that produces the Lexus car, which Friedman was singing praises about. And the company that produced that car, Toyota, was almost shut down in the late 1950s because it at the time tried to export this the first passenger car to the United States, which completely failed. And a lot of Japanese people said this is what happens when a country like Japan, which should focus on things like textile, is trying to produce motor cars. And if the free market economy at the time won the debate, probably they would have shut down Toyota by removing
protection and I wouldn't and have
subsidies.
A Honda.
No, exactly, yeah.
NPR reported yesterday that 1 in 10 American workers between ages 25 and 44 is getting paid docked to cover old debt. Mm. Even if consumers understand the economics, are we still at the mercy of businesses that have captured government regulators?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, a lot of welfare spending these days is going to the so-called working poor. You know, corporations actually getting subsidized by the government in that sense, yeah, because they are not paying enough living wages to their workers, and the government has to subsidize these people.
We did a story on that yesterday where many people who work for fast food companies in this country anyway also are on food stamps.
Absolutely.
And we are, I think it's something like $7 billion in effect subsidizing industries like McDonald's.
That's right, yeah. In this, I agree with Michael Moore, who, you know, called corporations welfare mothers, you know. I mean, these corporations criticize other people for getting government subsidies, but in that sense, they are massively subsidized by the government.
Just one more thing, and we don't have much time. Mm-hmm. On Thursday, Scotland is going to vote on independence. As an economist, have you looked at the chances that that could survive as an independent country?
Well, my view is, why not? I mean, there are a lot of small, very prosperous economies. Denmark has only 5 million people. Finland has even less. Switzerland has 7 million. So Scotland is viable. Unfortunately, in order to become like Finland or Denmark, Scotland needs a better economic strategy. And I don't think the so-called Yes Party at the moment has that kind of strategy, so I'm not so convinced that they'll do well.
Well, they are so tied to the British economy.
Well, actually, the Scots actually built Britain. Adam Smith was a Scotsman. And
in fact, the Scottish Enlightenment is exactly what we think of as the British Enlightenment.
Yeah, and the Bank of England was established by a Scotsman called Patterson. So actually, they built that Britain.
Okay, so you convinced me I'm voting for devolution. Next comes Wales. Hajun Chang, his book, Economics, The User's Guide, is published by Bloomsbury Press. Thank you so much for being on our show. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.